This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The World Bank has two big missions to accomplish by the year 2030. End extreme poverty and promote shared prosperity. Clearly two big tasks, but there has been some progress despite there being a very long way to go. In this hour, we'll hear two perspectives on the future of poverty and the role of capitalist systems in eradicating it. In just a moment, we'll meet Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus, but we begin with the World Bank. Joining us in studio is its CEO, Kristalina Georgieva. Kristalina, welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much for inviting me, especially on End Poverty Day.
Tell us a little bit about what the World Bank is focused on this End Poverty Day. Is there a particular cause of poverty, a particular opportunity for reducing it or eradicating it that the World Bank wants to tackle right away?
We want to see poverty gone everywhere, but we are particularly worried for the countries where the trend, unfortunately, is in the opposite direction. Extreme poverty is going up. Let me start from where we do see progress. In 81, 42% of the people on this planet were poor. That was 1.9 billion out of population of 4.5 billion. Today, there are 800 million poor people in a population of 7.3 billion. Huge progress, mostly driven by development and mostly by countries embracing this as an objective. Take China, 660 million people then, 25 million now. On that scale, though, if you are one of the 800 million people still living in extreme poverty, this progress means nothing to you. And if you live in a country where, because of wars or natural disasters or very rapid population growth or very bad governance, poverty goes up and destitution deepens, then you have all the reasons to feel that your country and the world is not doing enough for you.
Where do you feel that the World Bank has the primary influence in eradicating poverty? What is it that your organization, in your view, is trying to do that's maybe unique among all the other multinational groups in the world who are working on this?
What we do, which I think is unique for the bank, is to bring together investing in institutions and policies that improve the chance of development to succeed, and then investing in projects, especially projects that empower communities, give voice to people in the high corridors of power. What the bank has done over the years is to learn from its own experience, including from mistakes we have made. So we are more effective in targeting the most vulnerable and putting projects that improve their lives. And just to give you one example, we have been trusted with the so-called Fund for the Poor, International Development Association. It is now $75 billion. This is the largest we have ever gotten in our history. Why? Because we target big chunk of this money to fragility, conflict, violence, to address the most difficult reasons why poverty persists. And that turns into chance for girls to go to school and then enabled to decide on their lives. It turns into small businesses flourishing. It turns into bad governance being identified and eradicated, so countries have a better chance to prosper.
How, this may sound like a very crass question, but how much money would it cost to eradicate poverty?
Well, we have been doing assessments, and we came to the conclusion that it would be in the trillions, some 5 to 7 trillions to reach the sustainable development goals to be invested every year.
Wow.
And here is a very important observation to make, though. If we were tomorrow to wake up in a world where men and women are equal. This gender equality would add some $12 to $28 trillion to what we produce as a world. So actually, they sound like big numbers, but if we do better in how we live as societies, they are achievable. We are now, as institution, concentrated very much on making sure that money that is currently sitting in banks with low or zero or negative yield can transition to be invested in poor countries. And that shift in our thinking makes sure that money works for development, not only when they are part of our own projects, but that we create the environment for investments to happen.
So it sounds like part of what you're saying is that the cost, and you know, you said $5 to $7 trillion. If we were just to dump a lot of money on it now, I mean, the U.S. budget is about $5 trillion, just by way of context. But from what you're saying, it sounds like with each gain that we make, that alone has kind of a knock-on effect, that it has its own economic value that's not cash, but it's quantifiable in terms of the progress around the world.
That is exactly what I'm saying, that we can eradicate poverty. It is possible. We can eradicate hunger. Actually, hunger is the world's most solvable problem, because today we produce enough food to feed all people. What is on the way, and this is the message I want to leave with the audience, what is in the way are often human-made problems like wars, like conflicts. But we also live in a world where risks and shocks are more frequent and severe. Take the hurricanes that just hit the Caribbean. They can wash away progress of years. Dominica just lost 200% of their GDP because of 24 hours hurricane. So we live in this more fragile world, but we also can be more resilient if we have the policies in place that make development go further.
We're speaking about global poverty with the CEO of the World Bank, Kristalina Georgieva. We'll be hearing from Mohamed Yunus momentarily, but we'd love to hear from you. Share what you know about the effort to eradicate global poverty, particularly what financial systems and capitalist institutions, banks and businesses and entrepreneurs can do. Maybe if you are involved in one of these efforts and you've learned something from your own experience that you can share, we'd love to hear it. Or if you just have questions about how all of this works, what the factors are, what the challenges are, what you can do, now is a good time to share them. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Kristalina Georgieva, the World Bank released a preliminary report today that shows we're not seeing enough gains from generation to generation in upward mobility. Now, this is something that the U.S. has certainly dealt with in terms of the legacy of race and slavery and immigration and so on for different people of different backgrounds. Talk about, on a global scale, what's the one best thing that needs to happen to help break that cycle so that multi-generational poverty doesn't have to be your lot in life?
Get boys and girls in school, keep them there, and make sure they learn. And then opportunities for them would be much better. The biggest, and of course, I'm going back to make sure that governments have policies that are inclusive, that give a chance to people to reach their full potential. But if you were to nail me down on one issue, it would be education for all, for boys and girls.
I wonder what you make of some of the comments from President Trump regarding the World Bank lending too much money to certain middle-income nations like, say, China, which has other sources of financing. The U.S. has threatened not to contribute to a general increase in the World Bank's capital. And it certainly seems like there are more voices around the world who are more populist, more nationalistic, who are more focused on activity within their own borders. I know we have to pause in a moment, but what do you see the World Bank doing in response to this? Do you plow ahead anyway? Do you try to convince President Trump that that there's another way to go? What's the strategy?
Well, we got a fairly strong support, including an endorsement from the U.S. during our annual meetings to pursue an increase of our capital. And why do we need that? Because over 10 years of crisis, we threw at that crisis everything we had, and of course our capital is now restricted. And yet, demand is very high, especially in countries that are faced with criticality of instability. Take Iraq, or Egypt, or Afghanistan. We are a factor of development that benefits people locally, but we also help the whole world to be more stable and more secure. When we invest, for example, in the reconstruction of Iraq, it gives hope to people locally, it improves their lives, but it also makes the region more stable for everybody, including for the United States. And what we are doing with our investments in richer countries is to learn from them and transfer this knowledge elsewhere.
Michael emailed, "Seems to me that poverty exists regardless of the economic system, and that poverty is not an absolute, but is instead a relative condition, dependent upon one's place in the physical world and time." Well, Michael, I think there are a few people who would quarrel with you saying poverty just exists regardless, including our next guest, who will add to our conversation about how to make poverty history. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're continuing our conversation on how to eradicate poverty around the world with Kristalina Georgieva, the CEO of the World Bank. We're pleased to have her with us for a few more minutes, so if you do have questions for her, do send them in right away. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. 40 years ago, an economics professor in Bangladesh launched a revolution with a crazy idea: that a bank could trust someone with no credit, give loans with no collateral, and expect to get paid back. That crazy idea from Muhammad Yunus launched the Grameen Bank and won him the Nobel Peace Prize for proving the skeptics wrong. His systems of microlending and microcredit gave small loans, a few hundred dollars here, a thousand there, maybe less, but enough to totally transform the lives of the poor, especially poor women. Today, Yunus is trying to launch another capitalist revolution, not to destroy the system, but to rethink it, and to make more room for altruistic entrepreneurs who are driven by more than profit, if they even care about profit at all. His new book is called A World of Three Zeros: The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon Emissions. Muhammad Yunus, welcome to 1A.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
I wonder if you could give us your perspective on how we're doing with the fight against poverty overall. Clearly, as Ms. Georgieva has laid out, we've made progress over recent decades. There are certain reports that show that some of that may be slipping, sliding backwards. From your perspective, how are we doing? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? Are they about the same?
There are hopes. There are things have been achieved. Like Bangladesh, for example, achieved the Millennium Development Goal number 1, to reduce poverty by half by 2015. Actually, Bangladesh has done it 2.5 years before 2015. So this is a tremendous achievement. And we are looking forward to achieve the zero poverty by 2030, which is the SDG goal, Sustainable Development Goal. But while we do that, I have to emphasize that there's improvement, but there's no solution. It's not the end of the story there, because basic point that I want to raise that poverty is not created by the poor people. It's created by the system that we built. Unless we redesign that system, it will be impossible to get rid of poverty. Even if you do, it will come back because of the system that you have. I try to explain it by saying that poor people are like bonsai tree. You know, take the seed of the tallest tree in the forest and put in a flower pot. It grows only this high, 2 feet, 3 feet high. Beautiful replica of the forest tree, but it's not as tall. And you wonder what happened. The simple explanation is the seed is good, but you gave only a flower pot to grow. You didn't give the base. So the poor people are bonsai people. There's nothing wrong with their seed. Simply society, the system never gave them the space to grow as tall as possible. So that's where we went wrong. And what I did, tried to address that one simple way, to bring the financial services to the poor people. To me, financial services is like economic oxygen to people. You deny that oxygen to the billions of people in this planet by the system that you have. Then they become dysfunctional because they cannot economically breathe anymore. They become weak. So once you introduce that economic oxygen, they become active. They can take care of themselves. That part is to be redesigned. And this is one part. There are many other issues.
There was a report that came out this January from Oxfam that found that 8 men own the same wealth as basically the lower half of the whole world. Bill Gates, Amancio Ortega, who is a Spanish billionaire, Warren Buffett, Carlos Slim Ayllu, who is a Mexican billionaire, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, and Michael Bloomberg. The 8 of them have the same amount of wealth as the entire lower half of the world's population. I think a cynical American could look at their wealth and say, there is no way they're going to share. What's the incentive for someone at the top to help anyone that far down at the bottom?
Two questions. One, would they help? This is one. Another one, why should wealth all concentrate in few hands? This is the system that we built. It's a sucking machine. Capitalist system is a sucking machine which sucks up all the wealth and pushes it to the top. Today, we are talking about 8 people owning more wealth than the bottom 4 billion people on this planet. Tomorrow, it will be one person who will be owning more than that. The day after, it will be one person who will be owning 90% of the wealth of the world. This is the direction it's going. It's not reversing. So that's where it is. You say nobody should be left behind. I'm saying you built a system which specializes in leaving people behind. Mm-hmm. So because you're concentrating all the wealth in fewer and fewer hands, and it is an explosive time bomb. Anytime it can just blow up.
So how do you what would you say is step one? If we want to begin reversing that system and move toward a more equitable way of life, what might step one be?
Step one is go back to the system, that the capitalist system, which assumes that all human beings are driven by self-interest. That is the basics of it. Selfishness. I said, if all human beings are selfishness, this is the result you get. But the real human being, not the theoretical human being, the real human being is a combination of both selfishness and selflessness. That selflessness is completely kept out from the capitalist system in the business world. So I said, why don't you introduce that? Selflessness. And what we have done in Bangladesh, and now is spreading, we created another type of business. One that exists is a business to make money. We created a business to solve problem without any intention of making a penny out of that business. An investor can get by the investment money, but he or she doesn't take any profit out of it. Profit is plowed back into the system. We call it social business. So in that social business, you are all focused on solving problem after problem. When the human creativity gets around to address the problem in a sustainable business way, then all these problems can be addressed. At the same time, these social business, the more it become bigger and bigger space in the part of the economy, then they do not contribute in the wealth concentration because nobody is taking any profit out of it. Right. So they reduce that wealth concentration. If you can make it bigger, then you address the problem of poverty, unemployment, housing, you name it.
So you create a space within capitalism, not to say, oh, you shouldn't be making for-profit businesses, but you say, do that if you want, but there should also be room for businesses that exist for people rather than just for profit.
Yeah, this is
you can have both.
This is what we sell. Every business, big business, middle business, small business, we tell them, as you run your business, create a social business on the side. So that you bring your creative power to address the problem that you have around you. Take 10 unemployed people out of unemployment by creating a social business. Take 5 welfare people out of welfare by creating a social business. You run your business. So the more you'll do it, the more you'll be attracted to it. I keep saying that making money is a happiness, but making other people happy is a super happiness. So have a taste of it and see how it feels.
We're speaking to Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize laureate and the author of the new book, A World of Three Zeros, alongside Kristalina Georgieva, the CEO of the World Bank. I wonder, Ms. Georgieva, kind of to what Muhammad Yunus was saying in terms of this shift, this mental shift in the way that we view business. Mark asked on Facebook, what are the World Bank and other organizations doing to transition the world to a post-consumer, ecologically sustainable society? We cannot base human existence on constant consumerism with our limited resources.
What we do is to change the signals that are being sent. What is a good investment and what is a bad investment. And for example, the World Bank was the first institution to issue green bonds, the first institution to issue a sustainable development goals related indexed bond. The signal is that, as we just heard, doing good and financially being sustainable, they can be combined. We have been working with many countries around the world on that concept of environment, social, and economic sustainability, and how they can be integrated in the way societies function. And if I can make a point, what we see more and more among the younger generation is they embrace this product. Impact investing. We are now putting out for the first time IDA bonds. We go to market to raise money to invest in the poor countries. And the queue in front of the World Bank is a kilometer long or a mile long. Everybody wants a piece of these bonds because people want to do good and at the same time retain some financial sustainability.
Yeah, Dr. Yunus, you talk about that. I read the book, and you talk about that in the book, how there is so much disdain among younger people for the way that things are now, and so much optimism among the youth, including activity. Where are you seeing young people being the most active in terms of making the kinds of changes that you're talking about? Is there one particular example that you could kind of briefly describe that stands out?
Yeah, there are many, many examples. First of all, young people kind of feel depressed with all the negativity that goes around in the world, and they don't see a role for them. What do they do? Because they are in a generation where their parents already done everything that needed to be done, the house, cars, all the things that they are right. looking for. Today, what is it that we add to it? And this is a generation, I would say, most powerful generation in human history because of the technology in their hand. Their parents' generation never had that technology, and no other generation had that. They have the technology, they have the power. They don't know what to use the power for. That's the frustration about. When we come up with the social business idea, they say, this is a good option, that I'm not interested in making money for myself. I'm interested in solving problems. I can do that. And the key to the social business is creativity. And all people, all human beings, not just the young people. All human beings are packed with unlimited creative capacity. But the system doesn't allow that. System asks you to work for somebody. I said, that's the wrong thing. We are not born to work for anybody. So the employment kind of the direction.
Just go get a job somewhere.
Get a job. Yeah. As if getting a job is the end of life. I said, human destiny is not getting a job. Job is a tiny, tiny part of human destiny. Human destiny is much bigger than that. I said all human beings are born as entrepreneurs. That's what in our DNA. So we go back to it. We not only educate, we redesign the education system. Education system which only tells you get a good degree and get a good job. And that's the end of the story. That's not the end of the story. We go up, be entrepreneur, be in the world, be a social business entrepreneur, be a profit-making entrepreneur. That's your choice. But be an entrepreneur.
I know we have to let you go, Crystalline, in a moment. But for in terms of that entrepreneurial spirit, for people who look at these problems and say, well, it's a good thing the World Bank is working on this because I'm just... me. I'm just little me. I don't have $75 billion in my pocket right now. What does the World Bank want the everyday person to do to help contribute to these goals, briefly?
To recognize that in this world of ours where we are all connected and we all know what is happening somewhere else, what we see is aspirations converging. And we want to make sure that opportunities also converge. So you think in your life, what can you do so there is a chance for the world to be a fairer place? And to young people particularly, speak up. What we see in the world today is that hate is very loud. But hate is not predominant. What is predominant is actually goodness. Problem with goodness? Goodness is very quiet. So you and each and every one of us amplify this voice of goodness. A fairer world is a better world for each and every one of us to wake up in the morning and live in.
Kristalina Georgieva is the CEO of the World Bank. Ms. Georgieva, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you very much for having me. Great conversation.